Hello and welcome to the BCMA podcast. My name is Erica Matson and I'm the Executive Director of the BC Museums Association. It's December now, and we're starting to wind down for the year, beginning to look forward to a new year on the horizon. We've had a busy and productive year, and before we say goodbye to 2018, we wanted to share one of our highlights from the past year. Here, as a special episode of the BCMA podcast, we present you with a recording from the 2018 BC Museums Association Conference. We hosted the conference in Kelowna in October and spent three amazing days of learning, connecting, and celebrating with over 200 museum and cultural heritage professionals who traveled in from every corner of the province. We were honored to be joined by Dr. Josef Wask, who is one of our keynote speakers for the conference. His presentation on universal technologies and traditional innovations was recorded at the conference, and we are very pleased to share it here with you now as a podcast.
Who knows what I'm going to speak about today? That was the question that Nasruddin asked those assembled in the 13th century small village mosque in what is now Turkey. He was a venerable and yet mischievous mullah who traveled from town to town, and the people invited him to speak. Of course, when he asked the question, they all said, "No, of course we don't." To which he said, "Well, I'm not going to waste my time with a bunch of ignoramuses like you," and he turned and left the podium. They invited him back. The next day he asked, "Who knows what I'm going to speak about today?" This time they didn't want to lose him, so they said, "I do, we do." He said, "Good, if you already know, then I don't have to waste my time," and he turned and left. They didn't give up. The third day they invited him back. This time when he asked, "Who knows what I'm going to speak about today?" This time they had him figured out. So half said, "I do, we do." And the other said, "No, of course we don't." To which he responded, "Good, let those who do tell those who don't." And with that, he left for the last time. Let me explain what I mean by my title, Universal Technologies and Traditional Innovations. The conference theme was innovation and technology, but I felt trapped by those words, by how they are conventionally used. So I decided to open the conversation to include a more comprehensive perspective, and here is a breakdown of the title. Universal. We will be discussing some theories of the universe in an attempt to place our topic in greater context, in what I refer to as a comprehensive perspective. Technologies. I will attempt to define technology. There isn't enough time to give a full historical overview, but we will touch on an overarching description of technology as vehicle. Traditional. I will reintroduce the importance of tradition and the depth of wisdom. And finally, innovation. We will celebrate the constant birth of creativity, not just as a value in itself, but how it complements the past and drives evolution. Technology. I'm using the word technology in its widest possible connotation, not just to apply to machinery, electronics, automation, and high tech, but rather all the arts and building blocks of civilization, from physical mechanics to grammar and fine arts. Marshall McLuhan spoke about technologies as extensions of our bodies and minds. For example, the shoe is an extension of the foot. That is, it is a means of transportation. We then domesticated animals, invented the wheel, built wagons and boats. Then in more recent centuries, the train, automobile, airplane, until now we knock on heaven's door with space travel. In Lewis Mumford's groundbreaking 1967 book, The Myth of the Machine, Technics and Human Development, He observed that humanity's great discoveries were not physical tools nor the techniques based on them. A stone axe endures and can be examined by an archaeologist. It is natural that he should lay stress on it. Vastly more important to early humanity, however, were the intangible things that have left little or no trace: ritual, social organization, and above all, the tremendous invention of language. It could be argued that today we only use tech to refer to applied science, but remember that the word science itself derives from the Greek word scientia, meaning any knowledge. The word technology entered our language gradually. In the 1600s, it meant discourse on treaties or an art or the arts, from the Greek technologia, a systematic treatment of an art, craft, or technique, originally referring to grammar. The meaning science of the mechanical and industrial arts is first recorded in 1859, while the modern term high technology was not used until 1964, and high tech only appeared in 1972. The Roman philosopher Cicero praised the human ability to transform the environment and create what he called a second nature. Biblical literature also described people as being created B'Tselem Elohim, in the shadow or reflected image of God. We possess self-reflective consciousness and have evolved to become the universe made conscious of itself. All that we do is an imitation of nature, discovering, amplifying, or recombining nature. Now let us add a further dimension to the meaning of technology. It is not just an anthropocentric phenomenon, but rather a cosmological constant. It exists everywhere and always. Although we cannot yet say with certainty that we know why the universe exists, there are many theories. Douglas Adams, author of A Hitchhiker's Guide to the Universe, humorously conjectured that there is a theory which states that if ever anyone discovers exactly what the universe is for and why it is here, it will instantly disappear and be replaced by something even more bizarre and inexplicable. There is another theory which states that this has already happened. Some systems of theological, philosophical, and even scientific models of the universe speculate that it always existed and always will. Other mystical systems describe a series of emanations originating from an infinite non-corporeal entity that, in an act of creation, cascades through a series of metaphorical step-down transformers from the most subtle to the material. A beginning implies an end with a temporary existence between. Consequently, Gene Houston describes us as people of the parentheses, those who inhabit the great in-between. Just as humans use technologies such as tools and speech, so the universe uses wind and waves, gravity, magnetism, and stellar thermonuclear fusion. The underlying principle remains the same, extending from the microcosmic to the macrocosmic, from the single atom to the size of the entire universe. All that exists, including us, are technologies. According to this perspective, museums should also not be looked upon only as unique human constructs. The Earth has its gathering spots and protective spirits of place, as genius loci. Birds collect twigs to build their nests. Where there are no trees, then penguins gather stones. Crows and trickster ravens are attracted to shiny, useful objects. Rats hoard small objects. Dust drops where it will, winds gather the autumn leaves, and ocean currents collect their garbage at twice the size of Texas. The stars gather their adoring planets and nurture them as mothers their brood. The universe itself is the master museum, containing every wonder and mundane matter, making no distinction in the grand crucible of creation. What we once arrogated as a distinctly human activity can now be appreciated as a commonly shared activity. We are local ambassadors on Earth of a universal consciousness that curates the cosmos. I am not in any way denigrating the human species, although there is much to criticize. We are not just an encapsulated bundle of flesh and bones, but rather a grand experiment, a partnership of matter and mind. The technologies that combine to make us human are not necessarily all tangible, obvious, or perceptible to the limitations of our five common senses. Buckminster Fuller, the great inventor, architect, and global systems visionary, recognized that 99% of who you are is invisible and untouchable. There is also the more subtle sixth sense, in addition to the hundreds of even more ethereal faculties that populate the mindscape of our unfolding consciousness. The mind and thinking may be technologies, but they are also impregnated with magic. The poet, author, and naturalist Diane Ackerman recognized this when she wrote, "If a mind is just a few pounds of blood, dream, and electric, how does it manage to contemplate itself, worry about its soul, do time and motion studies, admire the shy hooves of a goat, know that I will die, enjoy all the grand and lesser mayhems of the heart?" Innovation. If technology is the thing, innovation is the fuel. We are both fascinated with and intimidated by innovation, by what the unknown future may bring. As the amazing Criswell Plan 9 from outer space once intoned, we are all interested in the future because that is where we will spend the rest of our lives. On the one hand, further innovation presents unlimited possibility, opportunities, and improvement. We use exciting words like frontline, avant-garde, newest technology, leading edge, new wave, and pioneer. Innovation represents birth, dynamic success, and renewal. We are also challenged by statements like this one from Jalit Burgess. "If in the last few years you haven't discarded a major opinion or acquired a new one, check your pulse, you may be dead." What is innovation? Why are we, for the most part, enamored by it? What is its seductive, even erotic, power? It is used to sell products. Even if you already have them, you can now buy the new and improved version of hard and software, products that entice with smaller or larger, faster or more powerful added features, often beyond your personal or institutional needs. Innovation is the reincarnated self, the messianic vision fulfilled, one that promises a more efficient organization, increased attendance, blockbuster exhibits, successful grants, award-winning programs, and dynamic media attention. It is the promise of new beginnings, continuation of the species, a potential achievement just when we ourselves might be feeling wounded by decades of wrestling with life's hidden gravities. Innovation is the constant birthing in multiple dimension. Isn't every second a revelation of time into space? So when we discuss innovation in its widest sense, we must ask Where did it come from, and where is it going? Why renewal, birth, creation? Does innovation as a technology of universal consciousness have a purpose, a goal to which it is moving? I think of innovation as Eros. The Greek Eros was a primeval god, son of chaos, the original primeval emptiness of the universe, but later tradition made him the son of Aphrodite, goddess of sexual love and beauty. In psychology and philosophy, Eros has been used as a principle of life energy. Its opposite is Thanatos, that which leads towards death, destruction, and the return of both physical and metaphysical matter to nothingness. Innovation is the fuel that drives technology. Innovation is the spirit, technology the body. We usually get blinded, profoundly distracted by the sensory impressions delivered by our senses and confused by the labyrinth in our still developing brains. We often think that we are acting according to our free will, when really we are at the service of our biology. We hunger for food and sex and power, the underlying reason being to preserve ourselves, our genes, our species. We may also act altruistically, but that also leads to the same destination. The power of creation does not just belong to the past, nor is it a one-time distant phenomenon, but a constantly reoccurring one of renewal. It is the cause of our curiosity and of our art. It is why all creatures procreate, just as it is manifested in the attraction between the planets and the sun, a cosmic love story of celestial proportions. Our conference theme was technology and innovation. We are a technology, a creation of the universe, using in turn our own created technologies. And innovation is an example of the fuel, the elan vital, the driving force that propels us forward. Our goal, the universe seems to be saying to itself, is to make your dream a reality. There is a danger that museums, along with universities and other learning or experiential institutions, may rely too much on innovative technology to solve their problems. It is not always a case of build it and they will come. Sometimes we invest in costly upgrades and we end up taking costly write-offs or even having to close the doors altogether. On the other hand, not referring, of course, to any museums represented by those in the room, many institutions exemplify the use of the label museum to mean what people on the streets sometimes say, a boring collection of dusty keepsakes. Derogatory descriptives are sometimes used to criticize us and our policies. Musty crypts of curatorship, graveyards for stuff, tombs for inanimate things that have been collected and caged, smug, lack of vitality or relevance, along with threatening voices reminding visitors not to take photos, not to express themselves above a whisper, not to eat or be nourished in the presence of the exhibits. We work for months, sometimes years, developing strategic plans that include general improvements and vast amounts of updated technologies. Some end up investing too much in these new technologies, and others, not enough. Sometimes we invest in technologies and wear them as masks, isolating the personal human engagement behind the protective face of neutral mechanics. And sometimes we just haven't thought the whole thing through well enough. Dr. Betty Stevenson, a former conservative member of colleges and universities in Ontario, was quoted as saying, "Universities are trying to meet 21st century problems with 16th century philosophy and working in an 18th century organization. If they could just get their centuries together, they might solve their problems. With some emendations, the same might be said for museums. But still, the imperative of innovation drives us forward. We are a pivotal generation experiencing the greatest revolution in technology since Gutenberg invented movable type in the 15th century. The print revolution resulted in an enormous democratization of knowledge, with information flowing more freely than ever before. The digital revolution has multiplied that effect many times over. A digital river of instantaneous communications has been released, a river without banks in a world without borders. We have now harnessed our brain power and live in the global brain. It used to be that if we wanted something, we had to go somewhere to get there, to be there. We had to go to the museum, to the library, to the market. The internet and other electronic media have usurped some of the museum's purpose, domain, privilege, and exclusivity. In an article published in the American Association of Museum News, Mitchell and Strimple observed that in the past, being present meant that your body was there. Now electronic telepresence and asynchronous presence are additional possibilities. These are less intense than face-to-face presence, but they can be achieved with greater convenience at a lower expenditure of time and resources. Museums and libraries used to be largely defined by the number of artifacts on display, the holdings in storage or books in their stacks. The digital age has now blurred such definitions. In revamped libraries, books are just one source of information among many others, and some librarians are referred to as information specialists, information architects, knowledge liaisons, or intelligence managers. I wonder what names for our curators we could come up with. However, the many benefits that accompany instantaneous access to an astounding amount of information and a worldwide network of museums signal a great transformation, one that was ripening for thousands of years. We no longer have to go out there, for it is now within us. The external has been internalized. We have manifested the world within us. This may seem like somewhat of an exaggeration, but it is evident by the technology that is in your pockets and purses, your smartphone, your personal data device, something that may one day be implanted. Virtual reality and artificial intelligence will be complemented by brain technology interfaces that interact with the brain and neural structures to translate thought into action. Futurists envision mind downloading and information uploading, a phenomenal feat, especially when considering that theoretically speaking, there are 100 trillion synaptic connections in the brain, more neural connections than there are atoms in the universe. Books, computers, or other memory devices will no longer be necessary. Our thoughts will be directly transmitted and be able to access universal knowledge. The snake in the garden, the irrepressible power of rebellious innovation, was correct about the transformative technology growing on the tree at the center of the garden. When you eat it, your eyes will be open and you shall be like God. Although we are among the most adaptable life forms on Earth, and most of us accommodate the parade of new technologies, some of us are wary of innovation and call it the devil's work. There have always been fearful reactions to new technologies. Train travel, for example. Critics of early steam-spewing locomotives thought that women's bodies were not designed to go at 50 miles an hour, and worried that female passengers' uteruses would fly out of their bodies as they were accelerated to that speed. Others suspected that any human body might simply melt at high speeds. Automobiles were called devil wagons, and some people were concerned that speaking on the telephone would cause impropriety, possession, or electrocution. To further illustrate the nature of belonging to a pivotal generation of living inside out, listen to this ancient Hindu story. One day, while playing in the fields, little Krishna, who was an incarnation of the Hindu god Vishnu, something his mother Yashoda did not at the time know, secretly ate some mud. His friends went and told Yashoda about this. When Krishna returned home to his mother, she scolded him. Like all children, he proclaimed his innocence and replied that his friends were lying. His mother, knowing his son too well, told him, "If you had not taken any mud, then open your mouth. I shall see for myself." When Yashoda looked into his mouth, she was wonderstruck. She saw the entire universe, the mountains, the oceans, the planets, air, fire, moon, and the stars in his small mouth. Even when Krishna is in the universe is still in him. This is the stage that humanity is approaching if we don't destroy one another and our planet first. The subcontext of the conference is keeping pace with acceleration. And yet we often find ourselves frustrated with Alice in Wonderland, who was told by the Queen of Hearts, "Now here you see, it takes all the running you can do to keep in the same place. If you want to get somewhere else, you must run at least twice as fast as that." Modern media constantly inundates us with information. I remember when my children were young, if I tried to explain too much to them, they would put their hands up to the ears and say, "Abba, too much information." TMI, we started calling it, which is sometimes I relate to my friends when I don't want to know so much. Another strategy that I've adopted is to embrace innovation, but balance it with a tradition like taking weekly Sabbath breaks from the computer. And you don't have to wait for the end of the week to do that. You can do it at any moment in the middle of the week or even right now. Let's spend a moment looking at the differences between information, knowledge, and wisdom. Information can be anywhere between an individual bit of news to a massive collection of circumstances. Knowledge is the organization of disjointed information into coherent systems. It is interesting here to share Einstein's observation, who said, "When I examined myself and my methods of thought, I came to the conclusion that the gift of fantasy has meant more to me than my talent for observing positive knowledge." This has also been expressed as imagination is more important than knowledge. Wisdom, however, requires fermentation. It only comes with age and experience. It is ancient, reflective, and partakes of dream time. Rainer Maria Rilke expressed this patient maturing unto wisdom in his poignant paragraph for the sake of a single verse. I don't have time to read the whole thing. The first two parts of it, he describes the experiences that you garner through living a daily life, through decades of living. And then he concludes, "And still it is not yet enough to have memories. You must be able to forget them when they are many and have the great patience to wait until they return. For the memories themselves are not important, not until they have changed into blood within us, to glance and gesture, nameless and no longer to be distinguished from ourselves. Only then can it happen that in a most rare hour, the first word of a verse arises in their midst and goes forth from them. That, my friends, is deep wisdom. That, too, is innovation, but not the kind that trips over itself in a race to become the latest and most profitable product. Those words took courage to write and composure to live. That is what Aldus Manutius, the Venetian Renaissance scholar and printer, integrated into his impressa. In the front of his books, it's a picture of an anchor with a dolphin wrapped around it, accompanied by the words in Latin, festina lente, which translates as, make haste slowly. While respecting tradition along with the venerable wisdom that it offers, you have permission as well as the authority to be creative iconoclasts. Museums, which themselves are technologies, are organized according to several working models, none of which are intrinsically good or bad. We are not transgressing some cosmic law when we redesign in whole or in part. There is no one answer. The following quote from Stephen Weil, the seminal thinker in the field of arts and museums, exemplifies this point. He said, "Museums are our own human creation, neither based on any changeless ideal nor occurring as a fact of nature, and they are a creation that we are free to shape and reshape as may best suit our needs." We are in the midst of the next great conversation. Ours is a swiftly evolving species, but it started slowly. It used to take tens of thousands of years to graduate from one technology to another, then a few thousand years, then 100, then a generation or two. Today, technology generations are no longer measured in human terms, but from the perspective of the products themselves, with a new generation of computer or operating software being born as we speak. It has been suggested that instead of reacting with disdain or becoming Luddites, that we should replace fear of the unknown with curiosity. Remember that all these innovative technologies are part of human evolution, are extensions of our senses, are acts of eros. As such, like love, we are attracted to them because they are either beautiful or useful. They are a manifestation of universal consciousness. They are not the enemy, but rather a vehicle of achieving our often unknown destination. Conclusion. To paraphrase Groucho, these are my conclusions. If you don't like them, I've got others. If there is a shared vision, a summation that you can take with you from the cornucopia of ideas that I have presented, it would be this. Give yourself permission to shine, but don't neglect the shadow. Work harder if you must. It is your creation. And feel deeper. Laugh with abandon and be moved to tears in the presence of beauty, for that is true aesthetic alchemy. At times, work is just work. You are there out of responsibility and discipline. Life may feel like a parade of stale moments that need to be endured in order to achieve your goal. At other times, however, you gladly suffer the ideal to bring beauty to others or for the sake of the perfect exhibit. These are the occasions when you are elevated to share your heart with more sensitivity and elegance than you ever thought possible. Remember the forgotten, for you are defenders of history, and know how to preserve both personal and public memory, often in the face of unspeakable tragedy. But it is not yet enough to preserve the past. You must also be activists, gardeners planting the seeds of tomorrow, inspiring possibilities and nurturing dreams. As gifted members of the Museum Nation, you come into daily contact with authentic artifacts as well as non-material culture. You, more than most, are recharged by these cathartic interactions. Be an independent thinker. Speak up and act out. Listen for the muses themselves to guide you. These inner voices and eternal spirits, as much as anything you've studied in school, are at your service. You are necessary partners in creation. You are a secular priesthood, learned elders and shamanic guides to the hidden stories, the profound mysteries of our various cultures. You are the noble gatekeepers, guardians of our treasures, masters of ceremony, and architects of experience. Our museums are not just other buildings crowding the landscape. They are also sanctuaries that preserve and celebrate the highest aspirations of humanity. We have only been granted a few decades of life and an even shorter time with the privilege of working in museums. Be bold, be brave. It is not just your responsibility, it is also your birthright, your inheritance, your opportunity, and your dream. Remember the big picture and go there often, but never abandon the details. The universal and the particular partake of the same essence, differing only in scale. Know that everything that is or ever will be is a technology. Technology is a handshake as much as a smartphone, and taking personal interest in a visitor as much as interactive electronics. Don't worry too much about keeping pace with acceleration. Stay current, but within reason. Respect tradition as much as innovation. Remain anchored in the wisdom of the past while constantly celebrating the opportunities of daily renewal. Tradition is not an archaic punishment. It is wings and roots, an archive of humanity's accumulated information, distilled into knowledge and ripened into wisdom. Recreate yourself every day. Forgive yourself and others every night. Remember the secret of the Sabbath, whether once a week or whenever necessary. Even now, in the midst of what the Buddhists refer to as the tyranny of an overly busy monkey mind. Now you, along with Nazarden, know what I was going to speak about today. In the end, I have come to appreciate all existence as a choreographed dance, a pas de deux of dynamic and static technologies. We are technology grounded in tradition and encouraged by innovation. The museum, whether walled or unbound, is a vessel that contains a microcosmic expression of universal principles. We too, each one of us, are an entire world. Our bodies may be temporary abode, but our psyches fly on the wings of forever. With that in mind, I'd like to share a closing poem. Museum as matter and metaphor, a contemplative stroll in an archetypal garden. Museums are inspired creatures. They are cajoled into existence by the grace-filled spirit of memory and are often temples, some grand, others humble, to the muse of history, an unforgiving master that hides none yet protects all. Museums offer deep reflections in timeless mirrors for as long as we can or dare see. Are we ourselves not also living museums? Do we not carry within us the memories of forever and the reach for exceedingly impossible goals? Are our faces not etched with the story of our lives, and do our eyes not betray both the spark and the tears of all eternities? Our bodies are maps for the literate, for those who would read us. Our minds treasures for those who would search us. Our feelings songs for those who would sing us. And our spirits still soar beyond the painful abuse of this world's temporary pilgrimage. Surely our journeys are permeated with a soulful metamorphosis, layered, profound, and breathless. So much so that in the end, we finally come to appreciate that we are all museums. Thank you.
For listening to this month's podcast. On behalf of everyone at the BC Museums Association, I want to extend my thanks to Dr. Wask and everyone who attended the conference this year. Our podcast will be signing off for the year, but we'll be back in January with a recording of Megan Richardson, our other keynote speaker from the 2018 BC Museums Association conference. In the meantime, please subscribe to us on iTunes or Google Play and listen to past episodes on the BCMA website, museumsassn.bc.ca. The BC Museums Association receives operational support from the BC Arts Council. We also gratefully acknowledge the support of the Royal BC Museum in providing a home for the BCMA Secretariat. The BCMA Secretariat is located on the traditional lands of the Songhees and Esquimalt First Nations.